This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Evolution has given the creatures that inhabit the Earth a number of coverings, scales, fur, and skin, for example. But one of the most remarkable, our first guest Tor Hansen says, is the feather. In his new book, Hansen traces the evolutionary origin of feathers, noting that they probably adorned some dinosaurs. He explains how feathers keep birds warm in freezing temperatures and cool in blazing heat, how they function in attraction and mating, and how they enable flight. Tor Hansen is a conservation biologist who studied birds around the world. His first book, The Impenetrable Forest, was about gorillas in Uganda. His book, Feathers, The Evolution of a Natural Miracle, has just come out in paperback. Tor Hansen, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, there are a lot of different skin coverings we see in the natural world. I mean, some creatures have scales, we have hair, some have fur. What's so remarkable about feathers?
So many remarkable things. So many. But I think if you want to boil it down to one comment, it is this. There are many, many things in nature that are beautifully adapted to a single purpose, but almost nothing has adapted to so many purposes as feathers. Those other skin coverings that you mentioned are marvelous in their way, but you don't see them with the diversity of structure and function that you find in feathers. You have a feather that can be the finest insulation that we've ever discovered. You have feathers that are wonderfully waterproof, structurally waterproof. You have feathers that are beautifully adapted to flight, perfect airfoils. You have feathers, of course, that are wonderfully adapted for display with incredible iridescent colors, long flowing plumes. So the diversity of form and function in feathers is truly unique.
All right, let's talk about understanding the evolution of feathers. And it's interesting, you know, fossils preserve bones well, feathers not so well. What do we now think we know about how feathers appeared in the evolutionary chain?
Well, we are probably as close to some kind of scientific consensus as we ever have been about the evolution of feathers and the evolution of birds, because the quality of the fossils coming out of China and the feather specimens that are preserved there tell us quite a lot about how they evolved and where they evolved. And it does appear that all the stages of feather evolution, those steps necessary to build the complex modern plume, occurred in a lineage of dinosaurs called the theropods, the meat-eating dinosaurs. It's a group that includes such famous dinosaurs as Tyrannosaurus or the Velociraptors from Jurassic Park. That story has gained a lot of new evidence based on the fossils now coming out of China.
And it's fascinating that these were not flying creatures, right? But we think they may have been, what, covered or partially covered in feathers?
Yes, there's great evidence now for feathers evolving in the theropods. And these creatures were primarily runners. They had strong, long, strong, overdeveloped marathon runner legs and walked on two legs and ran on two legs, which freed up their arms, perhaps, by one of the theories, to be feathered and used eventually for flight. But one thing that we really believe now about the evolution of feathers is that the simplest feathers, the first feathers in the series of steps towards building a complex veined feather, were not aerodynamic. So the first uses of feathers must have been for other purposes. And what's really amazing about the quality of these fossils is they're actually able to determine, in some cases, the colors of those early, early feathers, which gives real credence to the idea that an early use for feathers was display and color.
You know, you describe defeathering a wren, a little bird that you're in the habit of picking up birds and putting them in your freezer. Is that right?
Yeah, the freezer is a complicated place in our household. You dive in there for a bit of ice cream, you might come out with a vole or a woodpecker.
And the family's gotten used to this, huh?
My wife is very patient.
Well, anyway, so you defrost this wren and pluck the feathers. Just describe a little bit about that experiment and kind of what it told you about feathers and birds.
Well, in all of this research about feathers, I realized, you know, I really need to disassemble a bird, essentially, to get my head around this diversity of form and function. I need to look at these things in detail and see how they're arranged on a specimen. And it took me hours. There is a fellow in Ireland who holds the world record for plucking a bird. He can do a turkey in about a minute and a half. So it was hours for me to get through this wren. But I learned a great deal from doing so in terms of how the feathers are arranged and how many different types and just how many there are on a bird. For this tiny wren, I had well over 1,500 feathers by the time I was done. An incredible number of feathers, and it's a real testament to their importance for birds that, in general, the weight of their feather coat outweighs the dry weight of their skeleton by more than 2 to 1 in most species.
Yeah, you were struck by when you'd plucked the feathers, how little bird there was left.
That's absolutely right. The poor bird was just a bedraggled little carcass, whereas I had piles of feathers all over my desk.
I want to talk about some of the ways that feathers function in animals. But first, just tell us, what are feathers made of? What's their structure like?
Well, feathers are a protein. They're made of keratin. It's a specific keratin to feathers, but it's similar in general to the keratin that makes up our fingernails or our hair. Keratin is a very common protein in nature because it's tough stuff. And so you find it in the skin of animals or in these hard and horny surfaces or hair, things that have a protective function. So feather protein is one that is very well suited to feathers because it is lightweight and very durable and very tough, and it takes color well. So it is a protein-based structure.
So the shaft grows and then the little, what do you call them?
The barbs.
The barbs come off the feather in a variety of ways, and then they interlock as they grow, right?
That's right. The growth of feathers is truly remarkable. Now, we know how hair grows more or less. It grows from a follicle, but it's a simple process compared to feathers in that hair is just a bunch of dead cells stacked on top of one another, and they come out of the follicle. And we know they're dead cells because we don't bleed when we go to the barber unless we have a very clumsy barber. But on the other hand, feather growth is very complicated. And when feathers are growing, in fact, they're infused with blood because it's a complex process. If you injure the pin feather, the growing feather of a bird, that's quite a significant injury. It will bleed a lot. It's only after that growth is completed that the blood vessels are retracted from the base of the feather. So while it's growing, it's alive because you have this complex sort of helical process going on with the feather barbs growing from around the sides of the follicle and being attached to the rachis, that central shaft. So because it's so complex, you can do a lot of complex structural things with it. You can make these incredibly branched and delicate structures that have so many functions.
All right, when you really want to stay warm in the winter, you get a down quilt, I guess goose down. Why are feathers particularly good at keeping birds and us warm?
Well, feathers are, to this day, they are the most efficient insulation known. We haven't been able to match them with synthetics, and I think it boils down to that growth process and the fact that you can make these fine, fine branching structures. The key to insulation is what they call loft. How much air can you hold in a small space? And because feathers are so beautifully and finely branched, they can hold a great deal of tiny, tiny air pockets in that branched structure. And that's what people try to mimic with synthetics, but we haven't been able to match feathers for that yet because it's difficult to manufacture finely branched structures.
Now, there are seabirds that you say always stay dry because the feathers amount to waterproofing. And you described the story once of finding a seabird on a highway, a murre. A murre, is that what it is? A murre.
Yes, a common murre.
Right. And you say that when you picked it up, you wanted to make sure that before you tried to return it to the sea, that none of its feathers were disturbed because, well, why would that be the case? Why couldn't you take it back to the water if feathers had been rearranged or disheveled?
Well, MERS and other seabirds, occasionally when they're flying over land, they will mistake a road or a parking lot for water and they will land. And again, the real danger to them if this happens is that they damage their feather coat, because you can't put one of those little birds out in the icy water with a damaged feather coating over its belly, because if the water touches the skin of that bird, the thing is going to suffer immediately from hypothermia. The birds must maintain a waterproof feather coat at all times. And the way they do it is really quite remarkable. For many years, ornithologists believed that birds maintained waterproofing by applying preen oils to their feathers, and that the oils must be repelling the water. And the oils play a role, but they play a small role, because what's been learned is that you can wash all the oil off of a contour feather and then drop water on it and it will bead up and wash away. You know, you can scrub that feather with acid and remove everything and leaving only the structure of the feather itself, and the structure is waterproof.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with conservation biologist Tor Hansen. His book, Feathers, The Evolution of a Natural Miracle, is out in paperback. Well, let's talk about flying. How do feathers permit birds to fly?
Well, feathers are beautifully adapted for flight. But we do know now that flight came after the feather, in that the early stages of feathers were not aerodynamic. It's only the most advanced stages in feather evolution that have that aerodynamic structure. But ultimately, the result of all of this evolution is an incredible adaptation for flight. If you look at a bird's wing, it has a particular shape that is similar to the shape you would see if you looked out the window of an airplane. And that is an airfoil-shaped wing with a curved upper surface that gives that wing a bit of extra lift in the air. And a bird wing has that shape just as an airplane wing does. But what's amazing about a bird wing is that the individual flight feathers are also shaped like airfoils. You can see these feathers. They're often the ones that you might find on the ground that have been shed by a bird. The long, tapering, beautiful flight feathers of a bird are airfoils. So what you get for a bird wing is an airfoil made up of airfoils. And the bird has muscle control over all of those feathers. So it can constantly adapt and change the position of feathers and the shape of the wing to react to any change in air temperature or wind direction or air pressure, making it a truly incredible way to fly.
Now, Art, so in addition to insulation and waterproofing and flight, feathers make for very colorful plumage, and of course, a lot of birds will use them to attract mates. And I wondered, why is it so often in the natural world that it's the females that have these bland, camouflaged, paler colors, but the males who are so bright and ornate?
Great question. So this boils down to a very important theme throughout nature, and that can be summarized as this. Females are choosy. They have the ability to choose a mate, and because they can choose a mate, it produces competition among the males. And in birds, that competition has resulted in many instances in incredible feathered displays. In some cases, to the point where they're so ornate, they seem they can hardly function. I mean, look at the display of a peacock, for example. And so that has driven this wild variety of colors and displays. And on the other hand, you often see in those instances the females retaining a much more drab coloration. Well, that has an evolutionary purpose too, in that for many bird species, it is the females who are sitting on a nest to brood the eggs. And if you're going to be sitting there on a nest all day, it's a much better idea to blend in than to look gaudy.
Well, Tor Hansen, it's been really interesting. Thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Well, thanks for having me on, and thanks for all the great questions.
Tor Hansen's book Feathers has just come out in paperback. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. We're constantly discovering new uses for our smartphones. We write texts and emails, follow maps, surf the internet, and of course make calls. But while we're doing all this, our phone carriers are gathering enormous amounts of information about us. Our next guest, reporter Peter Moss, says we should be thinking more about what they're doing with it. Moss wrote in the New York Times in July that the device in your purse or jeans you think is a cell phone is really a tracking device that just happens to make calls. Cell phone carriers are holding on to all the information collected in smartphones, including text messages and our locations. And it was reported this summer that last year cell phone carriers responded to more than a million requests for information from law enforcement agencies. Peter Moss has been reporting on issues of technology and privacy for the investigative reporting nonprofit ProPublica. Well, Peter Moss, welcome back to Fresh Air. What kind of information are our cell phones collecting about us?
Our cell phones are collecting a heck of a lot more information than we expect them to be collecting about us. They are collecting where we are, not just at one particular moment in the day, but at virtually every moment of the day, where we move to, how long we stay there. This is location information that they collect and that the cell phone carriers collect and, most importantly, retain for sometimes quite long periods of time. They are also taking note of what we are buying, how we are purchasing it, how often we are purchasing it. That's just kind of a starting point of the sorts of very sensitive, very important things that these phones take note of, including, I should add, and this is very important, our text messages. These are things, unlike our email, that the cell phone carriers do store, keep on hand.
Right. And when we're talking about location information, we're talking about not just where we were when we were on the phone talking or texting, but where we were all the time. Is that right?
Yes. The cell phone companies, as a matter of just kind of their networks operating properly, they need to kind of check to make sure where people's phones are. So basically through either GPS tracking or through triangulation of the cell phone towers, they are at different intervals, depending on which phone company we're talking about, depending on where your location is, they are checking to see where you are and they are recording this information and they do hold on to it. That's very important information for them to have that they do retain.
And retain for some period of time.
It depends on your provider. Some providers keep it for really indefinite periods of time. Some providers do delete it or say they delete it after a relatively modest period of time. But the thing is that they really are able to do as they wish because there are no rules, federal laws, on how long they can or should retain this information for. And the thing is that for them, it's useful information technologically and understandably because they need to know kind of what the patterns of phone use are so that if they need to build more towers in a particular place, they know how many to build, things of that sort. But it's also potentially a gold mine of data mining information. When you know where somebody is, what they're doing, how long they're there for, that could be commercially useful, if not to the cell phone company, at least to other third-party companies that have things to sell. In addition to which, this is all very useful to law enforcement because if they are investigating somebody or something and they need to find out where they were, they can get that information from the cell phone companies.
Now, for a long time, we've known that law enforcement will go to the phone company when they're doing an investigation. If someone is a suspect in a murder case, they'll pull phone records and see who they've been talking to frequently for leads and valuable information. Does that now extend widely to geo-tracking information? Are they going to these cell phone companies to find out where we are?
Absolutely. And that's one of the, you know, innovations that cell phones offer, because previously when it was just landlines, we're talking about, well, you know where somebody is when they're calling from a landline because you know where that landline is. But now because people are calling from all sorts of locations, wherever they happen to be with their cell phones, police can find out where you are at the moment that you're calling, even if it's not your home where the landline is or the office where your landline is. And if you're investigating whatever it is, a robbery, a burglary, particularly things like kidnappings, of course, this is vital and really important information that they want to take advantage of. And it has become, and this is kind of particularly important here, it has become particularly easy for them to access this information, because back in the day with landlines, there were pretty clear, pretty strict laws about what the police could access, when it could access it, and what sort of judicial oversight was required. These days, because cell phone location technology in particular and the data that, you know, it produces is relatively new and so abundant, the law hasn't really kept up with it. So law enforcement is really not faced with as many limits as they used to be, and so they are availing themselves quite freely, it appears, paying modest amounts, to get a hold of this information pretty much at the drop of the hat.
In general, is it believed that there's a different legal standard for a case where the police are actually wanting to listen to conversations, you know, or get the actual content of conversations as opposed to simply find out where you are? Is it clear that there's a different legal standard for those two kinds of information?
Well, what you're talking about there is wiretapping, and there is kind of long-established, very firm laws about, you know, what police need to do, what evidence they need to have, what kind of judicial approval needs to be assembled in order for that to happen. Whether you're doing that sort of wiretapping on a landline or a cell phone, it is my understanding that the same long-established rules apply. The twist these days is that it's not as important to know what somebody is saying on a phone. What's very important these days and very useful these days and much easier to get is where they were when they were making the call, who they were calling, how often they were calling, where they moved to while they were calling. These things for an investigator turn out to be extremely important so that what you're actually saying on the phone isn't as important as where you were when you were saying it and who you were saying it to. And law enforcement knows who you were saying it to because they know not only the number you call from, but also the number you are calling to.
If you wanted to find out, will your cell phone company tell you what they're doing with your data?
You know, this is one of the marvelous things that we found out. I should say in particular, my colleague Megha Rajagopalan found out because she had the idea of calling up phone companies and saying, you know, hey, we know you've got all this information on me, location information. We know that you're providing it to law enforcement, fine and good. Can I please have a copy of it? And so Megha contacted her carrier, and then other people at ProPublica contacted their carriers, different carriers, and everybody asked the same question. Could we please have our location information? And the answer from every single one of these companies was, no, you certainly cannot. So the bottom line is, they will provide that information to law enforcement. They may now, or they may at some point in the future, provide that information to companies that pay for it. At this moment, they will not provide that information to you.
Well, Peter, you've recently written about the Federal Trade Commission and the challenges it faces in privacy regulation. And one of the points you make is that a lot of the valuable information that is revealed about the way companies may be violating our privacy has come not from federal investigators, but from other places. Do you want to give us an example and tell us about it?
Sure. I think the best example and the most kind of well-known one is Google Street View. And this is, of course, the application, the program that most people are familiar with, where Google has kind of gone around America and gone around some parts of the world, particularly Europe, and taken pictures of every street. And so if you plug in an address into your browser, you can get a picture of the street. Now, in America, there was some opposition to Google taking pictures of everybody's house, but basically the program went ahead and everything was kind of copacetic with that. And Google said, don't worry, we're just taking pictures of houses. It's not a big deal. We're not downloading any data or anything like that. In Europe, where there's a much more recent history in the 20th century of abuses of personal information, there was a lot more opposition because people were saying, wait a minute, what are you doing? Do you really have the right to take pictures of our houses? Is that all you're doing with these fancy cars that have all this machinery in them? And there was a data commissioner, a data protection officer in Hamburg, who basically insisted that Google let him, his office, inspect the hard drive of one of these cars to make sure that all it was doing was taking pictures. And to make a long story short, what he found out was that Google wasn't just taking pictures. Google was also downloading data from open Wi-Fi networks as its cars went down these streets. And Google had said it wasn't doing this. And a lot of personal information was downloaded by Google as it did it. Now, Google had also been doing this in the United States, but American authorities had not kind of pushed Google to the wall enough on what its cars were really doing. And Google is in a lot of hot water now with American authorities, but much more so with European authorities over what the Europeans particularly regard as gross violations of privacy in its Street View program.
Now, just to be clear about this, what Google was doing was going down the street and sweeping data from people's personal Wi-Fi networks, meaning potentially passwords and other personal information?
Anything that was flowing over an open Wi-Fi network as the Google Street View cars were driving past was downloaded by the Street View cars. Since they were moving from any one particular Wi-Fi network, unless the car happened to be stopped at a traffic light, most of the information that was downloaded was somewhat fragmentary because they'd be in the Wi-Fi network, and then because they're moving, they'd be out of it. But in that information, there were passwords, and there was more than passwords. There was partial financial information, and there was more personal information than that as well. So anything that was going over one of these open Wi-Fi networks, whether it was passwords, whether it was a note to a loved one, whether it was financial information, the Google Street View cars could have, and in some cases, did capture.
Now, in your assessment of the Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, and its efforts in this area, I mean, it's clear that they seem to be less effective than they are in Europe. And you make the point it's not because, as is sometimes the case with government regulators, the regulators are too close to the industry that they regulate. There are people of goodwill and smart people of goodwill trying to do a good job here, right?
Absolutely. They're, at the FTC, in the last couple of years, under the Obama-era chairman, John Leibowitz, there's been a lot of really top-tier privacy talent recruited to the agency. The problem is that they don't have as much authority as, in some cases, for example, European regulators have, because since the Reagan era, it's declined in many cases. I mean, the FTC in the Reagan era, before the Reagan era, had about 1,700 employees. Today, even though the economy is, after inflation adjustments, twice as large as it was then, the FTC has about a third less employees. So they don't have as much manpower to regulate as they did before the Reagan era and the whole kind of government move against, or political move, I should say, against regulation. And then, on the other hand, they don't have as much kind of authority. I mean, there are no privacy laws that are really written for most of the privacy violations that occur today, because we're talking, you know, stuff and technology that has developed just in the last decade or so that has been widely deployed only in some cases in the last couple of years, and the law hasn't kept up with it. And it's difficult, one has to admit, for the law to keep up with it because the technology changes so quickly. So even if you write a law today to protect, you know, our privacy on, let's say, web browsers on our laptops, well, more and more of us are using mobile phones to browse the web than laptops. So, you know, you've got to kind of apply things to this different technology. And who knows, 5-10 years from now, what sort of technology we'll be using to communicate each other and how it will operate.
You've written that the Europeans have been more aggressive in pursuing digital privacy issues than American regulators. When they have some success in this area, does that affect policy in the United States and regulation here as well?
Well, this is one of the very useful aspects of kind of, you know, the global nature of web use. For example, Facebook, of course, has about 900 million customers, and a huge number of those, quite obviously, are not in the United States. Now, when the European regulators ask Facebook to make a change or levy a fine against Facebook, and I'm just using Facebook as an example here, Facebook tends to apply all these changes, positive changes, to all of its customers. So the advantage of kind of this, you know, in a way it's outsourcing regulation, is that when a European regulator gets a major technology company, and most of the major ones are American, we're talking about Google, we're talking about Facebook, Twitter, et cetera, when European regulators ask them to make a change, those changes are applied in most cases to all of the technology companies' clients, including those in the United States. So we here in America benefit when a European regulator leans for privacy purposes on an American company. And that's one way in which our privacy is these days protected. And there's an argument that actually the European regulators in some respects have more power, or will use their power more willingly against American companies, because these are American companies that the Europeans are moving against, not European companies. And there are not the same kinds of concerns in Europe, for example, how is this going to affect Google's bottom line, as there might be in America amongst Washington politicians and other folks who do need to be aware of America's, and who are aware of America's competitive position and do take that into consideration. Nobody wants to shut down Google. Europeans don't necessarily want to shut down Google, but they're less concerned about Google's bottom line in Europe than they are in America.
Well, Peter Maas, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Peter Moss is a reporter for ProPublica. You'll find a link to his article about why cell phones are really tracking devices on our website, freshair.npr.org. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Most people in their 50s who've been to assisted living facilities have been there to visit parents, aunts, and uncles. But our next guest, Martin Bain, was in his 50s when he had to move to an assisted living facility 10 years ago, no longer able to care for himself because of young-onset Parkinson's disease. He was 32 years younger than the average resident. In an article published in Health Affairs and excerpted in the Washington Post, Bain wrote about living in an environment of disability, depression, dementia, and death. He's able to describe life in such a facility in ways many residents no longer have the capacity to do. Bain has worked as a journalist, lived for several years in a Zen monastery, and sold long-term health insurance. Now, though he sometimes can barely type, he shares his observations of life in assisted living on his blog, The Voice of Aging Boomers. And he publishes an online literary journal called The Feathered Flounder, which showcases the work of writers in their 60s and older. He spoke with Terry last Thursday.
Martin Bain, welcome to Fresh Air. So, just on a practical level now, in your life, what are the things that you can no longer do for yourself that require the assistance that you get at the assisted living facility?
I'm tempted to say everything. My mobility is not good, Terry, and I need help taking a shower or getting dressed. And when I was in my 40s, I was physically fit and very active, and to have to give all that up and stay in a wheelchair now and be helped by so many people to do the simplest of things, it takes a little getting used to. There were some periods of frustration I had years ago, but I think I've got it under control now.
So you were in your 50s. You were about 52.
Yep.
And you were there because you have Parkinson's.
Yes.
The other people in there were in their mostly 70s, 80s, and 90s?
80s, 90s, yeah. 70s is still pretty rare to find someone that young.
So that's something right there. Like, you're not only prematurely for your age in an assisted living facility, you're with people of another generation.
That's right.
And people who have probably some, many of them probably had some form of dementia, not full-blown Alzheimer's, but some kind of memory impairment.
That's fair to say, yeah. There's a what I call ambient despair. And that is the recognition that your fellow residents have such high levels of disability, dementia, death, and it becomes a part of your, I think, subconscious. And it's tough when you're living with, I live with about 70 other residents. Two died last week, and it was a shocker.
One of the reasons why I wanted to talk with you about this is because I think, you know, many people have family members who are in assisted living facilities.
Right.
They visit the family member in the facility, and then they go home.
Right.
And often, by the time your family member is in assisted living, either they're not able to be a very good reporter about what's going on there,
right.
Or you can dismiss it as, oh, mom's depressed, dad's depressed.
Sure.
This is the best thing for them. But you're almost acting like a reporter, being there and bringing the outside world the story of what it's like for you and the story of what your observations of are of other people.
I call it an observer advocate.
Mm-hmm. So let's start with some of the issues that I know have really gotten to you. Like, you've written about, like, the loss of control and identity when you enter an assisted living facility. I mean, on the bright side, you've got aides there. You've got people making your meals and cleaning your room. Those are no longer your responsibilities. But you write about the loss of control and identity. Talk about that a little bit.
loss of control. They have to be very careful. I'm walking a fine line here because the truth is, in the facility that I'm in, the administration, by and large, are wonderful people, wonderful people. But in many facilities, they're not. And they have a top-down management system, which starts, obviously, with the owners or stockholders, whichever the case may be. And they try and make you as compliant as possible, as quickly as possible. They don't need any revolutions. They want to put out a good face for the public. I was driving with someone else about a mile from where I live, and I saw an ad, a large ad for my facility, and there was a couple dancing. And I said to myself, you know, if I stood outside my room for 5 years, I would never see a couple dancing in my facility. But that's not what upset me so much. What upset me was the fact that we as a society have begun to think of what our elders are capable of as merely pinochle and dancing and bingo. That's such a waste of humanity. It really is. I mean, that's sadder, in my opinion, than cases of neglect that you see in facilities. To see someone who is or was a doctorate, had a doctorate, or was a high-level professional, or was just was good at what they did, it could have been a cabinet maker, and then to see them stop and become what I call elder zombies. It's very sad, very sad.
So do you socialize much with the people who also live in the assisted living facility?
As much as possible. I try and sit down and play the myriad card games, many of whom with names I don't even know. But it's not because I want to play cards, it's because I want to be around these people. So yes, the answer is as much as possible, sure.
Is it hard when somebody comes in and they're, say, you know, in their late 80s, some of their memories have faded, it's been years since they were active in their profession, if they had one, their spouse might have died, children living far away. And so they have this like long life with a lot of history that you're probably never going to know, or a lot of it you're not going to know. You're meeting somebody late in their life and knowing just like the tip of who they are and trying to encounter them as a full person but not knowing so much about their past.
That's where video comes in. I find video extraordinarily helpful in that respect. I try and get people on video as soon as possible, because you never know how long they're going to be here. And videos never let me down. It's wonderful.
How do you use it?
I just set my camera up on a tripod. I invite people in to sit down with me and talk for half an hour about anything that's on their mind. And I had a fellow in the other night that was weeping during a discussion of his role in a Navy disaster where one ship had hit another and a number of men died. For me, video is a very personal thing. It's almost like the most intimate form of communication that I can think of. And it allows me to sit there with the person, and for a few moments, we just let our guards down.
I think I get what you're saying. You're there as an interviewer, and that gives you, as I feel I often have when I'm at the microphone, the liberty of asking anything without feeling like you're being presumptuous.
Exactly, or intruding.
Or intruding, yeah.
Right, that's right. And I find that people that I've never talked to before in that way all of a sudden open, and their life spills out in front of me, and I am moved often to tears myself.
And what do you do with the video?
one of the first things I do if someone's died is show them the video, their children. I still keep them, but I always show it to the family if I do have a video of that deceased, sure.
You've witnessed a lot of deaths. Is death talked about? I know someone was telling me who lived in an assisted living facility that one of the things that really bothered them is that everybody there knew that death was either just a little down the road or a few years away, but it was close. But no one talked about it. And when somebody did die, that the administration didn't say anything, that you'd notice somebody wasn't at the dining room table the next day, that the room was empty, people were coming in to look at it, but nobody said that the person had died or what they died of. It was almost as if it would be too depressing to mention it, so they didn't want to bother the other residents with it.
Precisely.
What's your experience of that?
Well, again, this is a factor of which facility you're in, but I would say it's fair to say that on the whole, death is handled very poorly, very badly. And I think that setting up a time and a place to honor the person who has just died not only completes their life, but in a way brings a sense of even joy and release into your life. And it gives you a sense, I think, for everyone that life is purposeful and that we have to acknowledge, not hide under the rug. Death is also an integral part of who we are as human beings. And I think to talk about it openly, while in a way celebrating the lives of the deceased, I think is very, very helpful.
How has it made you feel about death to be so surrounded by it because the people who you live with are so old that, I mean, even if they weren't sick, you would have witnessed many of them die because you're talking about people in their 80s and 90s.
Right. It has dramatically. And I feel now much more relaxed about my own death than I did before. My relationship with almost all the residents is such that many of the people who die typically die slowly. I mean, there are some sudden deaths, but it's a slower process generally. And I'm allowed to kind of take part in it. This woman that died last week, I went into her room that night and sat with her holding her hand. And she died the next morning while her son was by her bedside. And I talked to her son, gave her son a hug, and I'm much more, I guess relaxed is the word I have to use again about my own death. When it comes, it comes. And whatever happens, happens. I'm told that 100 billion people have died up to this point in time on our planet. And none of them have come back to complain, so it can't be that bad.
So how did you become the person who goes in and holds the hand of the person who's dying?
Because I wanted to. I wanted to be there and people know it. I make an attempt when anybody new comes into the building to introduce myself to them immediately. And when people are coming to an assisted living facility, it's typically after a trauma in their life. They just lost a spouse. They have some terrible disease or they're in a stage of dementia where they can't live by themselves. And it can be frightening for people at that age to come in and all of a sudden have to deal with all this foreign new stuff. So I make it a point to go right up and introduce myself. And I think that my philosophy that it's the small things in life, the very small things that mean the most, that too has given me a certain position, if you want, in the community.
So something about your background that I'd like to bring up. You spent 5 years, I think, living in a Buddhist monastery on the West Coast?
Close. 4 or 5 years, yeah.
4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
And were you in a Jesuit monastery for a time, too?
I was in a Benedictine Catholic monastery.
Oh, for
a year.
For a year.
For a year, yeah.
So I'm wondering if the things that you learned there about meditation, contemplation, are helping you at this stage of your life and helping you live in an assisted living facility in an atmosphere that some people might find depressing. You know,
absolutely.
because people are so much older than you are and so much, you know, closer to death and often more seriously impaired and so on.
You know, the Buddha said that life is impermanent. And the time that I spent as a monk in both monasteries was without a doubt the most productive, powerful period of my life. And I owe, I believe, everything to the training that I received in both monasteries. One of the monks had built a small Japanese tea ceremony room, and I was reading a book one day it was in the room, and it said the Buddha had learned how to turn the stream of compassion within, and I dropped to my knees and started to weep. It never occurred to me that one could turn the stream of compassion within. Sometime later, I was on a plane to California to the Buddhist monastery to try and find out, how does one do this? How does one love themselves? How does one give oneself the benefit of the doubt?
How does one give to oneself the compassion that would come naturally when it came to caring for other people?
Exactly. Because in my experience, Terry, this is all a mirror. And how you treat yourself and how you treat other people is identical. Identical. The love and affection that you have for other people is only as much as you can afford for yourself. It was like a homecoming. I had forgiven myself, Terry, of all the things that I had done that I didn't think I should have done, or of all the things I wasn't, I thought I should be. I accepted them. And when that happened, it's indescribable, really. It's something so simple as accepting yourself, turning the stream of compassion within, yet it's such a powerful gift to not just myself, but to all those now I come in contact with.
Well, it's really been good to talk with you. I appreciate you making the trip to a radio studio so we could speak over microphones to each other so that the audience can hear you well. Thank you so much. Thank you for
Terry,
talking with us.
It was my pleasure.
Martin Bain speaking with Terry Gross. Bain writes a blog called The Voice of Aging Boomers and publishes an online literary journal called The Feathered Flounder. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Yowei Shaw. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.